All you're going to say is what?
Is this. I'll do the introduction.
Okay.
Is it on?
Yeah.
We'd like to welcome you, readers, who've been so faithful to us on All Souls Day that is celebrated in Mexico by the visiting of graves and the eating of candied skulls and skeletons in honor of the dead. And what better way, by some jiu-jitsu of tragic contretemps, homosexuality in literature.
And, okay, let's see that jiu-jitsu. Let's see the exact move you have to connect those two things.
Well, it's tragic.
Tragedy?
It's tragic.
Homosexuality equals tragedy?
Well, closet does. You know,
closet homosexuality?
The denial of it is. Of course it is.
I suppose.
Well, it's very tragic, man.
But, you know, the thing...
What's worse than being in the closet? I mean, you can't show your love for who you love, you know? That's a bad deal, man. All us artists get to show our love for what we love, right?
Well, we try, but then real people are not the objects of our art, right? I mean, like, real people are the messy, unknown quality that we're always trying to quantify and try and figure out, but never quite can. So I think maybe that's what talking about the homosexuality is, like, the messiness of it. Like, because I think all artists, right, are... Okay, so Kinsey came up with the scale. Everyone on some... No one is, like, 100% heterosexual. Or there are some people who are 100% heterosexual and some people are 100% homosexual.
Well, but we're
generally
mixing.
There's a bunch of people in the middle somewhere.
Well, we're mixing. See, it's a little, like you say, try to quantify. I'm going to take a little bit of the quantifying
out
of what you just said, because as we all know, we are born, a half our germplasm, if we're male, is female.
Right.
And if you're a woman, half your genetic code is male. So there's always this completion, right? And like I say, to go back, defending myself always, the tragedy of a closet, you know, eroticism is the inability to express it, right? And you're absolutely right. I mean, there are children born with two different sense of genitalia. This is just the facts.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can't get away from it.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex. Did you ever read that one?
No, I never read it.
That was pretty good.
Oh, so anyway, yeah, I mean, these are all great mysteries, right? But we're just going to keep it to Hawthorne and Melville, since we talked about Hawthorne and Melville last week.
Yeah, and just out of chance, you picked up this book, Homosexuals in History, which has actually a lot of it is dedicated to the ancient past, really. And mainly a lot out of England, because this guy's a scholar from England. But but he has a handful of Americans in here. And starts with Walt Whitman, who I think is a good place to start, because is incontrovertibly, why is that hard for me to say, Ren? He was homosexual.
Well, absolutely.
Like, he was definitely, there's no denying that he was.
But never expressed it.
No, he had tons of affairs, according to this, and they were well documented.
Actually. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I did not know that.
Especially.
Well, I had read somebody that said, I think it was Harold Bloom, that said, no, apparently he just, you know, was just, you know, gay and you know, sublimated it through his art, right?
No. Yeah. No,
I don't. See what I mean? You can't trust these academics.
Well, I mean, this guy's an academic.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, but he has, like, love letters to soldiers and stuff. Because when he was a nurse in the Civil War, he like met a lot of these. Mm-hmm. And he actually has one of the most interesting kind of quasi love affairs, which I think would be an interesting film script. Is he has an affair with a young Confederate soldier, who then moves up to the North afterwards, And so it's like, you know, conflictions of passion and where their loyalties lie and all that kind of stuff. That'd be kind of fun.
That's spectacular. Oh my gosh.
I think it would be fun. But he's definitely...
Somebody's got to do that.
Yeah, but then you actually have to write the fucking thing.
And yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. But, so, this writer, whose name is A.L. Rouse, and who I think is actually hilariously catty. Have you read a lot of
this? The English are catty. You haven't figured this out?
Yeah, but he's specifically talking about homosexuals, too. And he'll end a lot of paragraphs with just, like, catty one-liners that just crack me up. I'm like, really? This is supposed to be
like
a history.
Like, he wore really bad clothes.
Yeah. Or there's one where he's talking about Henry James, and there's this young sculptor who, like, never... Like, he suggests that Henry James, later in life, like, around 56... finally realized he was a homosexual, which I think is kind of a stretch. Anyway, so do you buy, when you read this, do you buy his conceit that both Melville and Hawthorne were gay and closeted gay?
This is what we're talking about. It's the whole problem of bias, right? Yeah. What we want in a writer is just no bias, you know, just tell the truth, right?
Yeah.
Try to get away from your personal feelings, right?
Yeah.
If the worst guy there in the room is a liberal, you still show that he's, or a surface liberal, you'll still show he's the most destructive person of the party, right? So you gotta have this.
Right.
You're an artist.
You can't just be prejudiced to your own...
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, and that happens a lot where the worst guy around is a so-called liberal, right? And we don't know Rouse's sexual orientation.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure we do.
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm so glad that, so as you know, Jonah, as producer and sound engineer, always tries to figure out how loud I'm going to laugh at any.
Oh, that one spiked time. For sure. That one's a huge spike. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the sinister part of this, but at the same time, he does support his theory in the, you know, in the text.
Kind of.
But again, it's just like Fox News. We're just going to, like, take this one little section.
Yeah.
And I have to tell the our great, loyal listeners that I'm kind of eating crow right now, because at least in some earlier podcast, I mentioned a good friend of mine who's trying to get a postgraduate degree at ISU, and is asked by the feminist chair, female, to read Benito Sereno and analyze it for its homoerotic undertones. And I went, fuck these people. Fuck these people. You should not read literature with this bias, right?
Yeah.
With the glasses on that you're going to see this. Yeah. I mean, which goes back to what we're talking about, A.L. Rouse.
Yeah.
Right? It's so criminal, because we're talking about art, right? You know, the last area where you can be, like, be just and free, right? So, but I read a couple of his excerpts, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's pretty, pretty honeyed.
pretty convincing. But at the, you know, well, it's interesting. I've been trying to think about this a lot, and for some reason I keep coming back to this notion of this sort of, like, ethical notion, which is strange to me, and I've never completely been able to figure out. But it's basically I talked to this guy the other day, and he lived in California, he met a girlfriend, he brought her back up to Idaho. She hated Idaho, right? All these diesel trucks. Every time she'd see a diesel truck, she'd go, ah, yeah, ugh, what is this? What is this fucking place?
And how they floor it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And blow black smoke at you.
Yeah, exactly. And one day they were going to go, they were hungry, and there was a Chick-fil-A right there. And she's like, oh, I could never eat at a Chick-fil-A because Chick-fil-A is part of the Christian rite. And then he's like, well, yeah, but it's, you know, it's right there. You know, it's like, well, what's the big deal? And on a certain level, I understand both sides of their argument. But I also think about it as, like, so after I got back from China, I had this terrible intestinal thing, and like, it's just uncomfortable for me to eat a lot of fast food. So I would just never, I don't really eat Chick-fil-A. But am I in the moral high ground for choosing that thing for no particular reason other than my own reasons for doing it? Like, where are the ethical boundaries for not doing something?
The ethical boundaries are totally justified. I mean, you got to sympathize with the young woman. I mean, these people are aggressive. They're mean. They're stupid. They want control. And they show it all the time. Like a guy who is like burning $2 worth of gas just to blow black smoke over you.
Right.
I mean,
I'm more sympathetic to that. But the chicken restaurant thing is a little bit more complex to me, because I'm like, well, who's to say, you know, the capitalists who, like, the liberal might be the worst person in the room. Who's to say a capitalist who's running a
multi-billion-dollar corporation.
Right. But they say they're on the side of good and right instead of just choosing to be, you know, be open and honest that they're on the Christian right or whatever.
Well, I'm glad we got this politics in here, because just 2 days ago I said, you know, corporations are horrible, but they are looking at the bottom line. And anti-Semiticism, anti-black, anti-environment, you know, anti-fairly decent behavior,
yeah,
they get rid of it for this very reason, right?
Yeah, but okay. So you this is hilarious, because you brought up, you actually know about this Kanye West thing that's going on. And there was a thing I saw on SNL about how the Goodwill, they said they were going to stop accepting Kanye West clothing donations. But my ex used to work at the Goodwill. They have no control over that. People just drop off boxes. like that's not how they're...
We're going to go through here and get every Kanye West...
Like, that's such a load of bullshit.
And that's a corporate thing.
Yeah.
But that's the point. I picked up this book, Jonah, and it was like how to become a millionaire. And guess what the motto was? The image is the function. And I'm going, gosh, writing a song where you've only got 3 minutes, every image has got to count. Yeah. It's the function.
Yeah.
And in terms of human behavior, the image is the function, man. I mean, I don't tolerate people around me, and haven't for a long time. I mean, the great member of my band, right? That, I mean, I don't tolerate it. It's like,
what, just, super image conscious people, is that what you think?
I just want love all around, man. I don't want anybody picked on. I don't want any people of any kind, except right-wing dickheads. You know, that's just how I am. Okay, so there we are.
Yeah.
There we stand. But corporations, in a way, and the reason that tilted my thinking was when Martin Luther King was given the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Coca-Cola is from Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
And there was going to be this big celebration of a Georgia boy is now won the Nobel Prize. Well, you know what was going on now, and the chairman of Coca-Cola just got the word out, you know, any of you boys don't like it, I don't care how much money you got, you're not going to make a living in this town if you don't do what I tell you. This is going to be a big event in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Martin Luther King, a black man, is going to be celebrated. And that's when I realized corporations, you know, are a positive influence. It's like the king. You may not like kings, but if they're good kings, you like them. You may not like corporations, but if they're good, I mean, you've got to have norms, man. I mean, that's what. And this Elon Musk, man, I look this motherfucker, man. He's from South Africa.
Yeah.
Now, really, you know.
And did you also know he's the heir to an emerald mine?
Of course.
Yeah.
In which black men go in there for 12 hours a day, you know.
Yeah.
And come out, and if they die in there, nobody really cares that much.
Well, yeah, I haven't looked that deeply into it.
Well, I mean, yeah. He's a motherfucker, man. He's satanic. I can't believe it.
That seems like a step too far. Satanic?
Well, this is why we have podcasts, so we can...
Yeah, go a step like too far.
Western thought, going a step too far.
Okay, so let's go a step too far. Do you think Hawthorne was a closeted gay man? By the evidence presented in this book, I am thoroughly unconvinced. I'm thoroughly unconvinced.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. And it always been, I do think Melville was. I mean, look, he goes to sea at 14.
Yeah.
And I've got a, you know, I've got a scene in my second book where I talked to a, you know, a special forces guy who talked about being in training for like 12 weeks at a time around nothing but men.
Yeah.
And how he started dreaming about men. And he said it really fucked with me. You know, and I don't know why I said, well, you know, if I had been around
for
like 12 weeks, I would have too, man.
But is that actually homosexuality?
It is not.
Right.
It is just... human beings need a little, you know, comfort, man. They need a little love, right?
Yeah.
And that was the fucked up thing about, pardon us for my language, that was the fucked up thing about Iraq, man. I mean, no bars, no prostitutes, you know, right? I mean, these guys, and nothing but chemical immersion. Iraqi war is the worst fucking war. It was as bad as any of them, man, for the soldier.
Well, they had, like, video games and stuff, so they had other distractions. They had other ways to fill their mind with clutter, you know? Which, I mean, there's lots of ways to fill your mind with clutter. I should know.
Right. So, no, my judgment is, and to follow up, thank you, is that when I heard about how how crushed Melville was when Hawthorne rejected him.
Yeah, well, kind of rejected, or just didn't buy into the relationship that Melville might have wanted.
Well, this is an interesting point, is that Melville and Thoreau and Emerson and, oh God, the cool woman who basically taught them all. I can't remember her name.
I can't remember.
But, I mean, the Transcendentalists were all abolitionists. And Hawthorne was appointed by Pierce, and as we said in the previous podcast, refused to take a stand against slavery. So that's the cool thing about the origin of a podcast, how sex and politics get mixed up, right? I had thought that Hawthorne rejected Melville because of Melville's abolitionist and adoration too, right? And Hawthorne wanted to hold on to his elitist, fairly tormented outlook on life. Like, life is tragic, right? And that's the interesting thing, is Melville was much more optimistic than Hawthorne. And I thought it was political. But when I read that book, I'm thinking, no, Hawthorne probably went, no, this guy's just a little too involved with me. I mean, I don't know if you've been that way, and I haven't either. But I mean, if you're at a party and you're just getting a little too much affection from somebody, whether it's female or male, you just kind of go, you know, actually, I just came here to have a drink, laugh, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
So we're looking for some feedback from our listeners. Okay, what's the answer here?
Well, you know, I think it's... I had this whole diatribe in my head, and now it's sort of slipping, but I think it was, you know, Melville ends up being more interesting. He ends up being the interesting figure that people talk about because he took more risks, whereas Hawthorne, you know, really kind of dedicated himself to understanding the puritanical society he was in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he basically stayed where he was, whereas Melville went out into the world and, you know, was...
I agree completely. I mean, if you were to look at the two books, Scarlet Letter, which is a masterpiece, and the Moby Dick, which is a masterpiece, I mean, one, the first one, is like a beautiful Edgar Degas painting of a ballet or something, and it's just beautiful and it's perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Moby Dick is just like, you know, cosmic. It's got everything, man. And you talk about you're absolutely right on. Melville took risks. Melville is out there just trying to like get hold of the world, just like Shakespeare did like 400 years before. It's like, okay, let's fucking do this,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might be a little messy.
Yeah.
But I'm going to try it, because why should I just do this little set piece, right?
Right.
And I'm just going to like, so absolutely.
And I think there's a chance that even if Hawthorne was gay, he just would have been too intimidated by that. This is not my purview. This is not what I do well. You're trying to rope me into the thing you do, and right. That's not what right. I do.
And he was the older man, and he was established, and he knew what he could do.
Yeah.
And Melville saying, God, come on, bust it open, man. I mean, you got Indians, you got history, you got these rivers, you got these mountains. Look at all that's happened. You got the history of the maritime trade. Hawthorne spends 30 pages writing about, you know, the difficulties of the... customs house, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no mention at all about the sea, right? I mean, no, I think one, it's great analysis. This is like writing, Jonah. The first anxiety for Hawthorne was, could have been this effusion of love that Melville felt for him. Mm-hmm. As a superior artist, as a great artist. And the second was, wait a second, he wants me to like get outside my little room, my little town here. I can't do that, man.
Well, yeah, but also in a way that was only about him. You know, it's like Melville wouldn't have and this is one of the things that artists a trap I think we can fall into is if we want something done, it's like we want it for our own reasons. And like I think Melville would have or Hawthorne would have picked up pretty quickly that Melville just wanted this for his own reasons. He didn't actually care what Hawthorne would have thought about it at the end. And maybe Hawthorne would have gone for it if he had been younger, but once you're older and established, maybe it's like...
You're talking about the artistic parameters that Hawthorne was comfortable with?
Yeah.
Or the sexuality?
Both.
Both?
Yeah.
Oh, well, absolutely. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, you're talking about two totally different personalities. I mean, Melville is a heroic character, man. I mean, he goes to sea at 14.
Yeah.
He knows this stuff, man. He has lived a life on a magnitude of 2 above Hawthorne. So for the readership, a magnitude is 10 is a magnitude above 1.
Now when our new segment,
when I
Will
say,
Talks Math.
When I say... I know. I learned this. I read this in a book. When you're talking two magnitudes, it's 100 to 1, man. Melville, in terms of just being running rivers a little bit like I have, the amount of difficulty and athletic, physical, just, you know, getting a boat off the Snake River. And we're talking about Melville out in the middle of the fucking ocean, man.
Yeah.
This is, and that's another magnitude. I mean, being on the ocean and being on the Snake River... One is pretty dangerous, but nothing like that, man.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, Melville is full of this. My new word is ebullience. Ebullience. It's got bull in it. Like, God, the amount of energy and skill and courage it takes to be who Melville was and then to try and write about it and the admiration he had.
Well, and then the coming back and realizing he has to do what Hawthorne does, which is sit in a fucking room by yourself for years in order to craft sentences that create the effect of time and cosmos, as you were talking about. Like, and that is, you know, that would be something that would send someone off the deep end. And he's like, hey, help me out with this, man. I did this whole other thing. Now show me how you do it your way, and then maybe I can benefit from it.
Right. But I'm glad you brought that in.
But then Hawthorne's like, well, no, why should I do that now? Like, what, you know, it's right, like right. that. We live two different
lives. Right. You brought another thing in. Melville is asking for support. Yeah, I'm doing this. I've done all these kind of nice little set 19th century adventure pieces.
Yeah.
And now I want to do this. And Hawthorne's saying, no, man, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's a brilliant, there. Now you got it into the triad, right? A lot of things going on. A lot of things going on. And of course, as we know, Moby Dick was decried and by the critics. They hated it. I mean, they had a nice little romance, tidy little romance, and now you've got something totally out of control.
You know, one thing I've never been able to parse concretely is, and I don't want to just say that I don't think Moby Dick is as spectacular as other as people think it is, but that's kind of how I feel. I mean, I think Type E is a page turner. You know, the thing that made Melville famous. The first time I read that, I was like, I was like, boom, this is interesting.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
You get to hear about the first encounter with Maori tattoos that ever existed for the white person, and like there's all kinds of little twists and turns that are really interesting. And Moby Dick for me is a little bit, I don't know, it's a little lost on me, I guess.
I've never read it all the way through.
Okay, well,
it's like
go.
The Bible.
Yeah.
I just open it up and I read, you know, two or three pages. But you're right, Type E is spectacular, man. It's just,
well, I've never reread Type E. I wouldn't.
No, it's really good. I actually, you know, I had to reveal this, but I took a 4-hour graduate course on Melville.
Yeah.
And we read everything, and it was really good. It was almost as good as the Nabokov. I hate to say it, man. I graduated from the University of Utah. Man, they had a great, great literature program there. Oh man. And I also read Faulkner, too. Man, I'd like, boom, Faulkner, Melville, and Nabokov. That's a pretty good triad, man. 4 hours. I only had to take, like, we would go in and do 4 or 5 hours a week, man. It was great. And so I got into Melville, and I got into
why hasn't anyone ever suggested that Nabokov might be a little bit gay? I mean, he was married the first woman he ever knew at like 18, spent a lot of time away from her, and then just lived with her his whole life. I mean, for an artist, that seems pretty rare. I mean, it seems like he's maybe covering something up.
Well, I love it. Well, there is one thing is that Nabokov parades his infantile heterosexuality. I mean, that's like the centerpiece.
Yeah.
Right.
The flaw, or it's a parody of heterosexuality.
Well, the point is that, gosh, we name Kundera in every podcast. Now we get to name Proust.
Oh, yeah.
Proust, you know, was gay, and he just makes Albertine. I mean, all the jealousy scenes are homosexual jealousy scenes, right?
Yeah.
But he sets it in a heterosexual format, you know, to make it, you know, more sellable, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because this is 1900. And on top of that, they're prosecuting Jews as they always have. And so, yeah, he's watching out a lot of ways. But Nabokov, and the other interesting thing about Nabokov is that Nabokov hated Freud.
Yeah.
But I have to take Nabokov's side on this, totally. there is no room for psychological intrusions into a work of art. I mean, let's talk about how good the story is, how wonderful the creativity is. Is it real? Does it have emotion? Does it have, do you feel the soul of the work, right?
Well, isn't the whole point of art that there's room for anything if it can be put in well? I mean,
I agree, but that's the reason. But that's the other reason I never really, you know, I'll read. I read the beginning of Remembrance of Things Past. I always read the overture.
Yeah.
L'ouverture. Because it's just like pre-adolescent, and it's just a child wanting so much for his mother to come up and give him a kiss, and he creates all these pretexts for disrupting daddy's party. I mean, it's so beautifully Freudian, you just can't believe it.
Yeah.
And it's so wonderful and true and heartbreaking. And that's the only extended page I read, because basically all it is kind of false, you know. It's these beautiful, you know, architectural paragraphs with all these descending subdominant clauses. And, oh, okay, I get it, but wait a second, man. And the irony is he was a soldier, you know. He knew a little bit of something. So I said, you know, that's the other thing. We must fight against phoniness and fraudery in literary criticism, because there is so much. And I mean, even a dickhead like Harold Bloom will say, wait a second, this guy named Banks did The Tempest, in which, in 1968, in which through post-colonial justice, Caliban sodomizes Prospero as a symbol of, you know?
Okay.
Right, that's true. He did a production of The Tempest in London. Are you familiar with The Tempest?
Yeah.
That's the play, man.
Yeah.
That's an outrage.
Well, it's...
You don't... Shakespeare's like, great, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely rewriting.
Why would you sodomize Shakespeare?
Well, don't call it The Tempest.
Don't call it The Tempest?
Right, yeah.
There you go, the dishonesty of it.
Yeah.
See, that's what I'm saying. I just don't like dishonesty in art.
Yeah.
I mean...
Call it something else. Call it, you know, make it a play about a producer who wants to make one of the characters sodomize Prospero. I mean, like, that could be interesting, yeah. Even, you know? Like, it's
and probably
about,
better.
Yeah, it's about desire.
Well, you know it's going to be better.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, I know Shakespeare sells, and so it's about him trying to talk the director into making a play that's about... and then the director's pushing back. He's like, but that's not even fucking Shakespeare anymore. What are we even doing?
Right.
And there's all these kinds of like pushbacks and stuff like that.
And the irony of it was, 6 months ago, Banks died. And NPR, this is what I'm saying. This is why I'm really, I mean, I'm left-wing, but, you know, and I like NPR.
Tom calls NPR National Pablum Radio.
It is. So Banks dies at the age of like 90.
Yeah.
Rich, you know, famous.
Of course.
And Steven Seagal does this memoriam of Banks, right?
Steven Seagal?
Well, I don't know, Peter Seagal.
Oh,
Joey
yeah,
Seagal.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Peter Yeah.
Somebody like that. Anyway, does this, and I knew a little bit about it, so I kind of prick up my ears. It's like, and he's going, you know, and he just was such a, you know, a trailblazer in innovative theater productions, right? And it's like, I go, oh, fuck you, NPR. Fuck you. Because every, like I say, man, I am not anti-anybody except anti-control. And you do have, I mean, he knows their NPR is going to play to a segment of the audience that is gay, and so we're going to just kind of honor a gay icon, right? Well, that's bullshit, man.
Yeah.
You honor people for the honesty and the beauty of what they do, man, not whether they find it where they found a following. Look at Kanye West.
Yeah.
Jonah's laughing at me because my beautiful squeeze gave me a smartphone and I'm reading all about Kanye. But I mean, yeah, he starts as a rapper and then he builds it up. And I mean, we're just talking about a whole bunch of fucking phonies, man.
Well, I mean,
but he's got 30 million people and now he's selling clothing and everything. And so should we blame Kanye? I blame NPR. I mean, wait a second, man. This was a travesty. And the guy gets away with it because he has garnered popular support, a marketing segment. All you have to do is get a marketing segment. So I have to ask you, Jonah, why have we only gotten like 120 viewers? We need a bigger marketing segment.
Yeah.
Could you work on this?
I'll get right on it. There's people you can pay for that kind of thing, of course. As soon as
Don, isn't that how it is? Yeah. How money always seems to work right into it. Yeah.
As soon as Don Draper walks in the bookstore, we're gonna be huge.
Who's Don Draper?
Mad Men. He's like an ad executive guy.
All we need is money, man. Yeah. To make more money, and that's what they tell you.
No, what it's what you said about rich people, right? It's about image. It's like if you can fake it, you can make it seem real,
right?
But to me, that always seemed like too high a price to pay. You know,
yeah. It's the highest price ever, man.
Yeah, it's super.
Because you know what it is, becoming a fucking phony.
Yeah,
it's so fucking horrible, man.
Yeah.
I just met so many people when I was a kid that they'd gotten a job, you know, with an accounting firm or something, and they'd look at me and they'd say, yeah, and everybody acts like this is so important, and they'll give me a smirk because they want me to like them, right?
Yeah.
And I just look at them and I go, well, you're still taking the money and you're smirking, so really, who gives a fuck, man?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you want it both ways, you know.
Well, you know, to me, it's kind of, I think about it more in a Buddhist sense of, like, you know, they're still dealing in human, in a certain kind of physical payback for their actions. Like, well, you know, maybe I have to be a phony for this, but then eventually I'll get the nice house, and you know, that'll be worth it, and. But I mean, there's definitely a larger way of looking at it, being like, well, you know, that's all going to fade eventually anyway. So,
well, the problem is that you're deferring the cost, you know. Mm. I mean, you're going to be a phony for 10 years, and then, okay, now I'm going to be a cool guy and give the local paper.
Right. This is Albert Camus' The Fall, really, you know.
Boom.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right, man.
Yeah.
That's why people read Albert Camus.
Well.
Because that's the fucking real deal, man. But I just see the attrition of those 10 years. What has it done to your kids? What are your kids like? You know, what's your marriage like? What's your soul like? You know, all this, face it, man. I'm so damn happy to be who I am.
But, you know, us artists.
Had everybody pissed off at me my whole life. It's just so wonderful. Except the people that matter, of course.
The people that matter?
People that matter, yeah.
The people in charge, is that what you're saying?
No, the people that are cool have always liked me. Yeah. The fucking losers have always hated me. I see it as, I mean, I'm going to put that on my gravestone, man.
The losers have always hated me. I feel like that won't age well. That won't look good on a gravestone.
Why not? Well, I'll do a second paragraph.
Yeah.
To explain it.
Yeah.
What's the longest fucking gravestone text in history?
No, since we're talking about Day of the Dead, though, one thing that's always flabbergasted me is why aren't there more like significant amounts of paragraphs on tombstones? Like, I know it's kind of hard to etch things into stone.
Mm-hmm.
Probably weakens the stone a little bit.
I think it's you know, the Greeks said that it's the civilization degrades. I mean, you should be able to get a paragraph.
Yeah.
You know, at least 100 words on a tombstone.
That would make cemeteries so much more interesting.
Right, right.
Like, what's the point of it? I mean,
right.
Get 100 words on a...
I know. right? But Jonah, you know what? I think we have to make a pass. You and I both get an obelisk. About 6 feet high.
Yeah.
Plenty of room. And four sides. Four chapters. It's true.
Oh my gosh.
It's true.
That would be the project of a lifetime.
Oh, it's true.
Now, writing on an obelisk.
Hell, now you can just etch it in stone like by computer, man. It's not that hard.
That's true.
It's like,
yeah. Yeah, you could fucking do it in plastic. Plastic will last longer than stone. You could do a plastic tombstone.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. You could do a...
This is a watershed moment for me, man. I'd have been thinking of granite the whole time.
Yeah.
Or quartzite.
Yeah. Well, now that you have a smartphone and you know about Kanye West, it's time to move onward and upward. Or not onward and upward, but fucking whatever you call it.
I know.
Technologically sideways.
I know. Gosh. Well, you know, you just go all these years, man, you just don't have the right concept, man. Plastic, exactly, man. That plastic's going to last 100 years anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, especially a hard block, yeah. Hard polymer.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Although that does take a lot of...
Oil. And then the art historians will say, well, it originally had a gold enamel covering on it to protect it from the rays. But that has gone away a couple thousand years ago, right?
That would be amazing, yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, what could be better? Well, look, the Homeric hymns. Most of the great Greek poetry was on gravestones.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. They were beautiful poems. Here lies Orchilochus, you know, who lived by his sword and to buy his bread and drink his wine.
Mm.
You know? Boom.
Yeah.
The origin of the haiku was
on
tombstones, yeah.
That's great.
You know, you gotta say, Western thought is fairly wide-ranging.
We've covered
a few
topics.
The Russians, the Greeks, the French, the Mexicans, the Jews. Who else?
All homosexuals in all those categories.
Yes, 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 yes. So we need a nice.
Except for lesbians, we gotta talk about lesbians. That would.
Oh, I mentioned one of those, but I made amends to them. So we need a nice little jump shot.
Yeah.
To end this podcast.
Do you want another beer to do that? Or?
No, I gotta go.
He's gotta go.
I gotta go see my squeeze.
Well, let's see.
He bought a new car today, man. This is a big day.
It's a celebratory day.
Celebratory day.
A jump shot.
A little bank off the side. High off the glass. Maybe just a layup. A little bank off the side.
Maybe a left-handed layup for me. Because those are a little bit more difficult. I feel a little bit more impressed when I do those. fuck, I don't know. Oh, you know, I do have one kind of, which is from going back to homosexuals in history. I feel like what I partially got out of this was that the suggestion that there was a certain amount of patronage by some of these kings, especially like Frederick II, that was homosexual in nature. Not only were they supporting these artists, these poets and the like, they were kind of doing it for their own reasons about...
So I get Frederick I and Frederick II mixed up. One of those Fredericks supported J.S. Bach, who was a good Lutheran guy with 12 kids.
Yeah.
And Carl Emanuel Bach, J.S. Bach's son.
Well, you got to throw some heterosexuals in there. You know, you can't just have that little.
Was that
gay,
Frederick one or two?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
We got to clear this up, man. We cannot disparage the memory of Frederick.
Okay.
He was one of the great.
I'm gonna do my best to try and find it really fast, but that means you're gonna have to fill time.
Oh, just thinking about listening to a little J.S. Bach. Da 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 Da, 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 da. Oh God, so wonderful. That's so wonderful. It, you know, human culture, human life is so wonderful. We don't have to choose between great artists. I mean, there's so many. Oh man.
Okay, this says Frederick the Great.
So again, we've already established that Rouse is gay and has an agenda, just like Banks. Yeah. And so he's basically chicken shit. And
No. It's a fascinating take on trying to tell history, I think. Because,
well, you're right. He could be, but the point is, and I think that's what we have to bring away from this podcast, is that Melville, I mean, it just doesn't matter. Do great art. Break the boundaries.
Yeah.
Be a great human being.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, man. I mean,
absolutely, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. It does, absolutely. And
But it is interesting.
It is interesting, but you know, I have to read it. See, I haven't read it. The interesting thing to our readers is that after our Hawthorne and Melville podcast, the very next morning I went book scouting and found this book. And Jonah came in to edit the podcast, and I said, "Hey, read this, man. This is pretty good." But yeah, no, man, I'm. Gosh, the incontrovertible theme of this is whether these people were closet, ambivalent, da-da-da, whatever, they gave human life such riches, right?
Yeah.
Every one of them. And
well, which is what he gets to mine by trying to explore their sexuality, which is just to actually explore the other things about them that were interesting, which happened to coincide thematically or tangentially with their own life, right, and their sexual proclivities, because your sexual proclivity by chance is going to connect with the art you make, whether you like it or not.
Right. Not necessarily. But again, this goes back to my anger about this this woman at ISU telling her students to read Benito Cereno for homoerotic content. I found that as control, as false, and I didn't like it. And
well,
I
but stand the control is on her part.
Saying, it is.
Saying read it for that, this reason.
I hate that.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. That's fascist. That is control.
Yeah.
That's pre-biasing, and you just mentioned it just now. I mean, that's what this guy did. He kind of like picked potential suspects, which is just what the fucking, you know.
But he doesn't criticize the art at all.
No, of course not. Yeah. I mean, and just what I'm saying, I'm just saying that there are, in every work or every book, there's this kind of like kind of thing. You're going, wait a second, okay. He's just going to look at.
But weren't you
and,
the
but
one?
But let that, me make this. Okay. Let me make this metaphor. I mean, if you're a black guy, and there's been a robbery, and you're walking down the street, what are your odds of getting picked up for the robbery? Against a black man or white man's?
Depending on
10 to 1.
Yeah.
10 to 1, man. Yeah. And it's the same thing. I mean, what I hate is dishonesty. Basically. If you want to know what I really believe in, I grew up, my dad was a doctor, my mother was a nurse. They were professionals. The ethics was to do the job right, to not pre-bias, you know, do the job. And whenever there's a hint of, well, because the person's this or this, or whether I want to see it this way, I'm going to categorize or I'm going to arrange, you know, how I treat the world, right? I mean, that's the whole evil, man. And it goes both ways. And I just think you made a very good point about this book, is that he has thought, okay, which ones are going to fit into my program, right? Hawthorne, Melville, whatever, Frederick. It may be true. I'm just saying that the whole bias takes away from the beauty of the book. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but those weren't his primary interests. I mean, this is like on page 300, and you know, he's kind of trying to fill out the book a little bit.
Right.
I mean,
there you go.
A lot of it is like his classic. It's got Francis Bacon and the Elizabethans and the Renaissance. I mean, which is the Italian Renaissance is rife with speculation about.
Flagrante, man. I mean, well, you know, look, the point is made. If you were in America, I'm just going to do a sociological general problem. I'm going to use Heisenberg here.
Okay.
Probabilities.
Okay.
You grow up in a little town.
Yeah.
You're gay. You're black. You're Hispanic. You're Jewish. You're not going to go into the pharmacy or trades or whatever, you know, or, you know, whatever. There is a chance you're going to say, I'm going to do music. I'm going to do theater, I'm going to do art, I'm going to do art criticism, I'm going to do things that I love, because I'm pretty much going to get fucked every other thing I do, right? I can't play athletics, can't go in the military.
Well, but a lot of them did, though, right? I mean,
They did, but they're all closet, though.
Yeah, but...
They were all closet, but the point is, I mean, I think the psychological thing is that people that have life, they've got talent, they've got passion, they've got love. What is open to them to fulfill, right? And on top of that is the mental toughness to say, look, this is my only chance. If I'm black or I'm gay in America,
right.
I've got to do it through my talent, you know. Novels, poetry, theater, art. I mean, that's open to me, and I can, well, even more, I'll go beyond that. This cannot be denied me. This cannot be denied me. I can do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to work harder than anybody else. And I remembered a Southern guy from North Carolina, Washington County, and he says, you know, I went to law school, University of North Carolina, and there was one guy that was there in the library when classes ended at 4, and I would go back periodically to just check a fact or two, and he'd still be there till closing. He was a black guy. There was one avenue open for him, you know, and that's a big deal, man. In terms of being a human being.
Yeah, but, like, okay, but would he have noticed if it was a white guy? Like, there was, I mean, presumably this is a pretty large school.
Good point.
I mean, there's got to be more than one person who's studying pretty hard.
Well, you talked about Melville, you know, all this experience sitting in a room and working at it. You know, I just contend that I'm right. I think that if you have a lot of spirit and you want a life and everything else is close to you, you are going to work harder than anybody else to get that done.
I don't fucking know, man. It seems to me that it's the stupidest thing anyone could do. Yes. There seems really no practical.
He means writing,
to me.
Gentle listener. He means being a writer.
Yeah.
I know.
So, yeah. I mean, I can see it on other avenues. I mean, it's specifically with, you know, athletics. Obviously, that's a huge deal. But
the other thing is to follow up. It's not just the doing the work. It is, you know, working your way into a publishing house as a janitor, you know, doing anything you can to get close to the other side of what's going to make you a famous writer, like Truman Capote, you know, or...
Was he a janitor?
He got a job as a copy boy or something.
Yeah.
And but I mean, not it's not just that; it's the obsequiousness and the, you know, Paul Simon. Paul Simon was a gopher for one of these companies.
You know what?
He was a fine musician. And he played a lot of stuff.
I fucking hate these stories. I really do, because they're all like narrativized after the fact, and it all happened when they were like 21, and by the time they're 23, they're fucking famous, and to me that's like, no, what about your janitor? You're 30 years old, okay? This isn't just your first job. You've been a janitor everywhere, like
Jonah.
Jonah
is being disingenuous right now. Jonah would not be obsequious for like 2 weeks. It would not happen just to get one of his short stories published. He is not going to do it. It's just your character, man.
Well,
but if you really wanted to get published and were able to do anything to make the contact with the people that were going to publish you, you would do it.
Yeah, but to me, then that you avenue not, never seemed clear at all.
It never seemed clear to you because you never thought about it. But I'm telling you, somebody, man or woman, who wanted more than anything to get published would do everything possible to get in that venue. It would mean living in New York City or wherever. It would mean doing whatever was possible, man. Huh. And that is the story of a lot of people, man. It's the story of a lot of people.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough.
But the temporal, you're right. How long did Paul Simon run around saying, hey, Paulie, would you go run down the street and do this? Oh, yeah, I'll be right there, man.
Yeah, he didn't do that for a decade.
I agree with you.
Yeah, he did that for 2 weeks, and then he goes on David Letterman and says, oh, yeah, I was a gopher. I was a gopher at this record company. Yeah, fucking barely at all, motherfucker. Like, once for like, I think it was like 2 weeks, probably. They just turn it into this.
Well, that's why Western Thought has such great balanced reporting. Balanced and fair reporting. Okay, we gotta go, man.
Okay, hold on. Let me finish. This is completely outside of anything, but A.L. Rouse wrote this. This is from, this is him talking about the philosopher George Santayana, who sounds pretty interesting. He makes kind of a convincing argument he's gay, I'm not really sure. But this is him talking about Whitman. I know you're not a big Whitman fan, but I like this quote. The influences to which Walt Whitman was subject were as favorable as possible to the imaginary experience of beginning the world over again. Liberalism and transcendentalism both harbored some illusions on that score, and they were in the air which our poet breathed. Moreover, he breathed this air in America, where the newness of the material environment made it easier to ignore the fatal antiquity of human nature. He imagined, as not a few Americans have done, that his own world was a fresh creation, not amenable to the same laws as the old. There is clearly some analogy between a mass of images without structure and the notion of an absolute democracy. This dream is, of course, unrealized and unrealizable in America as elsewhere. What Whitman seized upon as the promise of the future was in reality the survival of the past. So,
That's brilliant. That's beautiful.
The
last line totally threw me, so we'll have to save that for the next podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, I followed him until that last line, and now I'll have to think about it. So that's tremendous, Jonah.
It's incredible. Yeah, it's difficult, but yeah. I like that idea.
He's totally right until that last line, and then I'm going, oh, where'd that come? But he's probably right.
Well, past and future is like, it's so nebulous, you know. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Tremendous, man.
Are you going to sign off?
We're going to sign off.
Okay. You don't want to say anything in particular?
Hey, just think of your loved ones. It's All Souls Day. Think of your loved ones and the past.
Perfect.